This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity.
Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The summer and fall of 1776 was a critical time in the Revolutionary War. George Washington and his troops were defending New York City and were about to suffer a major defeat. At the same time, there was a northern front in the war that centered on activities in Lake Champlain. British soldiers contemplated an attack on Albany and the possibility of combining their forces with the group in New York City. The Battle of Valcour Island in October of 1776 played a key role in this struggle, and many historians feel its outcome had a major impact on the war effort. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk with author Jack Kelly, who has just written a fascinating book detailing the people and events of the Battle of Valcour. Jack, welcome to Vermont Edition. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. It's great to be with you and talk about what I think is probably the biggest Revolutionary War story that focuses on Vermont.
Exactly. I think it's a story that a lot of people are going to enjoy, and they may not know that much about it. Jack, I have to say right at the outset that I thoroughly enjoyed reading this book. It is a wonderful narrative of events that many people may not be all that familiar with. And as you say, it's probably the biggest event in the Revolutionary War involving Vermont. And you certainly raised the possibility that the history of this country could have turned out differently if this naval battle on Lake Champlain had a different outcome. The book is largely written through the lens of three people: Benedict Arnold, who many people know for his traitorous behavior later in the war, but they might not know about what a brilliant naval strategist he was. Also, Horatio Gates, who was a former British war officer, and Philip Schuyler, who was a general in the American Army. Before we get into the details of the book, let's just sort of set the stage for the Battle of Valcour Island. It's 1775. The British leadership in London, well, they've said enough is enough. They've had it with this American rebellion. The time has come to crush it. And this leads to a northern front of the battle, that being along the Canadian border. And there are people in the American government who think annexing Canada might be a good idea, that folks in Canada would be really receptive to this policy. And as a result, we see efforts by American troops to fight in Canada. Tell us about that. What was going on?
The invasion of Canada is not a aspect of the Revolutionary War you hear an awful lot about in the history books, I think partly because it's a little embarrassing that the patriots, freedom-loving patriots, their first impulse was to invade another province. But the other reason, and probably the more important reason, it was a complete disaster. They did send an army in 1775 in the fall up to Canada. They took Montreal. They moved up the St. Lawrence River to Quebec City, which was a fortified city. And they got bogged down there, and they were never able to take it. They stayed all winter. In the spring, as you mentioned, the British sent the largest expeditionary force in their history, over 10,000 men to Canada and 40,000 men to New York City. And as soon as those redcoats arrived on the scene, the American army essentially collapsed. They retreated 200 miles back down to where they had started out, which was in Fort Ticonderoga and Crown Point on the southern part of Lake Champlain. And that army was totally beaten. They left behind a lot of their supplies in Canada. They had very low morale, of course, and they were suffering from an epidemic of smallpox. So it was a very inauspicious beginning to a campaign that they had to stop this British invasion that was now going to come down through the St. Lawrence, down the Richelieu River into Lake Champlain, and then down Lake George and connect up with the Hudson River and go to Albany or point south and make New England very vulnerable from attack from behind, essentially, sort of the back door to New England. So that was the situation as it evolved in July of 1776.
So there really were two pressure points on the Americans. One, William Howe, I believe, in New York City. And then we have General Carleton coming down from Quebec. There are two ways to really put pressure on the American military with the goal of combining these two forces.
Yes, and the campaign in the North, as the summer progressed, took on more and more importance because Washington was getting beaten at the other end of this corridor, the corridor that ran all the way down these waterways and rivers. George Washington lost the Battle of Long Island in August. He was forced out of New York City in September. He was beaten at White Plains in October. And by November, he was retreating across the whole state of New Jersey and ended up in Pennsylvania. So it was a complete debacle at the southern end of this long corridor. So it made it more and much more crucial that they stop the army that was coming down from Canada. And to do that, they had to quickly build a fleet of very improvised gunboats and war vessels and meet the British up on Lake Champlain at Valcour Island, which is just below what's now Plattsburgh.
You mentioned smallpox. What role did smallpox play in this whole battle or leading up to the battle, and how devastating was it for the American troops?
Well, it was a serious problem early in the war. Most of the British Army, the men in the British Army, would have been exposed to it already. They were exposed. It was endemic in England. But in America, in isolated towns and farms, they were not exposed to it at all. So when Americans were exposed to it, they tended to get a much more virulent form and have it spread what we now call super spreader events. Army camps were the perfect way to spread a contagious disease. They didn't really know how. They knew it was contagious. They didn't know how it spread. And it was devastating. It was about 10% fatality rate. The men who survived were sick for weeks. So they caught it when they were up in fighting in Quebec, and when they got back down to Fort Ticonderoga, of the 5,000 men who came back from Canada, about 3,000 of them were sick with smallpox. They had to be quarantined until they recovered.
Jack, we got this email from Peter in Colchester who writes, "I just started reading the book, so I don't know whether it speaks about Carleton's Prize. Is the story true about how that name came to be? Is there a backstory we need to know about this?"
Well, it was later in the campaign when they fought the battle at Valcour Island. This was a major naval battle. Americans had a fleet of gunboats and small war vessels. The British had larger war vessels and an actual ocean-going frigate that they brought down onto Lake Champlain with a lot of cannon. They fought the battle at Valcour Island. It was a standoff, essentially. Benedict Arnold had a strategy that he would hide behind Valcour Island until the British went by. And then when the British turned around to come back towards him, the wind was pretty strong from the north and prevented their main ships from getting into the battle. So the Americans were able to match them gun for gun all day during the battle. This was in October of 1776. And then, although their boats were very badly shot up, one of the gunboats, the Philadelphia, sank right in Valcour Harbor. Arnold then led them out by going very close to the New York shore and slipping past the British fleet and escaping to the south. When the British got light the next day, they're waiting to finish off the Americans, and the bay was empty. And the General Carleton, who was leading the expedition, was irate and flabbergasted. And they saw what they thought were sails on the opposite Vermont side of the lake. and they began to shoot at them, and it turned out it was not sails at all. It was just some trees on an island, a very small, little, really just a rock sticking out there. That little island was referred to, ironically, as Carleton's prize, because it was the only prize that he got out of the battle. Whether it is true, it's one of the stories that's handed down, so it's hard to know exactly. You know, there's no written record of it, but that's the tradition.
It's a great story, and we want to, a little later in the program, talk about some of the very specifics of the battle. Right now, we are going to talk to Charlie in Baldwinville, Massachusetts. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the program. Well, I think, unfortunately, we lost Charlie, but Charlie's question was, if you could talk about the involvement of the Native American tribes at this time, and specifically in this battle.
Well, the at this point in the war, there was Native Americans on both sides. And they served, for the most part, as scouts or raiding parties that would go out into the woods and could maneuver through the woods. They were not really a major force on either side. The Americans had what were called Stockbridge Indians, or I think they were a Mohican tribe originally, and they'd settled in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And they had been converted to Christianity, and they were sympathetic to the Patriot cause. And so they went up there with them and served as scouts and pretty minor roles. And the same thing for the Indians that were in Canada that sided with the British, and they served the same type of role. So they were involved. Certainly all the Native Americans in the region were concerned. This was really their land, and they had still maintained a pretty good grip on the territory up there. There was not a lot of settlement by Europeans along Lake Champlain yet, but that was pretty much the role they played in this particular battle.
Jack, there are all sorts of interesting side stories in your book as well, and one of them you tell about a meeting between Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen at Fort Ticonderoga. Is it fair to say when they meet at Fort Ticonderoga that they are very different, they have very different personalities when it comes to military strategy?
Yes, that meeting took place in May of 1775, a year before the campaign that I discussed in the book. But the fact that they were able to take that fort, and they combined, Benedict Arnold provided some leadership, and Ethan Allen had the Green Mountain Boys and provided the men who took over Fort Ticonderoga, was really one of the crucial moves in the whole war. If the British had reinforced Ticonderoga and held Ticonderoga and Crown Point, it would have put the Patriots in a very awkward position, because the British would have been right on their doorstep. They would have been in America with a force where they could just reinforce them and continue on down. The fact that they, in 1775, before word of Lexington even got to the men at Ticonderoga, the fighting having broken out at Lexington about 3 weeks earlier, Allen and Benedict Arnold combined to take over the fort. It's usually depicted as they were, Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold were sort of enemies. They did become, they have a lot of conflicts later. But I think in that day, in that moment, Benedict Arnold had no troops, so he needed the Green Mountain Boys to take over the fort. And Ethan Allen, though he had been a leader of this kind of ragtag guerrilla force in what was then the New Hampshire Grants, they called it, what's now Vermont. He wasn't a military expert, so I think he actually welcomed Benedict Arnold to provide a little bit of discipline They were both very avid for the cause. They were both insisted on that it was going to come to war. The Congress, which was meeting in Philadelphia, actually considered giving back for Ticonderoga because they had not yet reached that point. They were still sort of hemming and hawing. It was maybe that we could find a way of reconciling with Britain. So once they took over Fort Ticonderoga, it was a big push towards war, towards all-out war with Britain. It probably as significant as Lexington Concord was, and then a month later, Bunker Hill. So very interesting development. And I think, like some of these events, it's been downplayed in the history books because of Benedict Arnold. Because Benedict Arnold, nobody wants to sing the praises of Benedict Arnold, but he took over for Ticonderoga with Ethan Allen. He saved the day at Valcour Island, and the next year he fought at Saratoga. And some of these events have been downplayed because he was involved in them.
Let's talk to Dale in Montpelier. Hey, Dale, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much. Very interesting program. My question is, I loved Kenneth Roberts' novel, Rabble in Arms, which is where I learned about this part of our history. And I was just wondering how historically accurate his story was.
Well, Dale, that's a question that I've had from many, many people, actually, a surprising number of people, and it was a book that I love myself, very well written, very dramatic. And it's, Roberts did a lot of research, and I think for his time, and there's things, minor variations have emerged since he wrote that book, which was, I can... not sure exactly when it was. It was quite a while ago. And for the most part, it's pretty accurate. And I'd say it would only be some of the smaller aspects or things that have been uncovered lately that would sort of clarify what he was talking about. But it's a great book, certainly.
Dale, thanks for your phone call. You know, the one thing that I really that struck me, Jack, reading the book, is people have an impression of who Benedict Arnold is because of the fact that he was a traitor to the country. And he really had a remarkable naval career before that, didn't he?
Yes, he and not just naval, but he was a very successful businessman in New Haven when the war broke out. His father and then he himself had a fleet of trading vessels that would go down to would go up to Canada and they would go down to the West Indies. And he made his money because of the British impositions that were put on trade. He had to do a lot of it as a form of smuggling, but he made a lot of money and he was one of the wealthiest men in New Haven. And very adept at sailing, and he knew about the sea, and he knew how to be a sea captain, which required you to be pretty tough guy to deal with your, you know, the men on your ship. He had no military training when the war broke out, but he had this instinct for for military strategy and tactics, and served the country very well. Up until the Battle of Saratoga in 1777, which is only a year later, the war was just really getting going. And then he was severely wounded there, and he turned to his dark side. And as I say, really his treason became such a black hole that it sucked in all the other things that he had done. The sort of heroic aspect of his career was sucked into that, and he became just a synonym for a traitor.
And did he feel that he was treated badly by the military and was overlooked for leadership positions because other military folks might have been jealous about his career?
Yes, he felt that, and he was right. He had, and George Washington, who was very much loved Arnold and was, you know, a promoter of Arnold, agreed with him. He said, you know, you deserve the promotion. After Valcour, he was not promoted. He wanted to become a major general. Eventually, he was promoted major general, but they didn't give him his seniority that he deserved, so he would have been ranked among the lower men who were much less accomplished. And he, a part of it was his own personality. He was a very prickly guy, very very quick to take offense, defend his honor. He and so, somewhat of a purist, I think. In a way, he was almost a victim of his own enthusiasm for the cause. He wanted to. He didn't try to understand that there was going to be a lot of politics involved. There was going to be compromise. That was not his thing at all. And he didn't know how to play politics, which he had to do, really, because it was Congress that decided the promotions in the Continental Army. And George Washington would recommend, but he just had to take whatever Congress decided. And so Benedict Arnold was not able to play the politics he needed and curry favor with people. And he was treated quite badly, and that set him on the way to his treason. But, of course, there were many other officers in the Continental Army that had the same type of treatment, the same disappointments in getting promotions and so forth, and they didn't switch sides. So it's not really a justification, but it's a way of understanding what his thinking was.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Steve in Fisk Point. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
What's on your mind today?
Okay. This might or might not lend credibility to the Carlton's Prize Island, which I have been by many, many times as I do a lot of fishing down that area. From my home in Isle of Mott, I can head straight down, and I go by that Carlton's Prize. I saw the plaque on the side of the stone, and I had to you can't see it from my boat, so I had to get out and swim in, climb up on the rocks, and read about it. But the most interesting part of the whole scenario is on the west side of that big stone mound is what appears to be a cannonball embedded in the stone, a perfectly round circle metal object embedded in the stone. Now, I'm not an archaeologist. I don't know if someone can go down there and check it out. But visually, anybody that goes down there and just will sit and look at that mound from the west side looking east will easily see this. It doesn't take binoculars, doesn't take any special vision or anything. It is right there.
Well, Steve, Jack, have you heard about this?
I never heard about that, and it's a fascinating point. I would think over the years that archaeologists would have examined that and come to some conclusion if it was, in fact, a genuine, remnant of the Revolutionary War era. But who's to say? I mean, it's very possible that's embedded there from the guns of a British ship in 1776.
Steve, thanks for telling us about that story. Fascinating information. Let's turn to Barry, who is calling from Essex, New York. Hey, Barry, welcome to the program.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I own the marina in Essex, and I was just wondering if he could discuss the historical significance of the town of Essex in that Battle of Valcour.
I'm trying to. Essex is near. Let's see. Is opposite. Is that near Split Rock?
Yes.
I don't know about the town. You know, there was. I don't think the town of Essex actually goes back to the Revolutionary era, but because there really were no towns on Lake Champlain at that time, there was a few settlements and like very few, very sparse settlements. So as far as I know, there was no town there at the time. But Split Rock was a very prominent feature of the lake. It was where the really wide part, the northern part, narrows down and then significantly narrows down farther to the south. And that point was where, after Arnold escaped from Valcour Island and the British essentially chased him down the lake, or was towards the south on the lake, that's where they caught up to the American fleet. They took one of his major warships captive, captured about 110 men, and there began then the last gasp of the fight that started at that point and then continued down to what's now called Button Bay area. And in that battle was another cannon duel. The British pretty much wiped out the American fleet and forced Benedict Arnold to ground his ships and set them on fire rather than surrender and allow the British to have the ships. But the actual battle lasted over 3 days, and it pretty much extended from Valcour Island all the way down to Crown Point along the lake.
Barry, thanks for your phone call. I also want to mention that there's some great maps at the beginning of the book. I love looking at maps and then be able to refer back to them as you're reading through the book. There's some wonderful maps of the upper and lower parts of Lake Champlain and the points of battle for folks to look at. Let's talk to Lars, who is calling from Portland, Oregon. Hey, Lars, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on. I just wanted to follow up on the comment about the cannonballs. I grew up in South Hero, and I've studied Carleton's Prize pretty thoroughly. I'm also a novelist, and my first book was actually titled The Prize, and it's about the circumstances around the attack that happened at Carleton's Prize. But the reason that I was inspired to write about that was because while I was growing up in South Euro, I knew people who had actually collected cannonball fragments from the lake bed there around Carleton's Prize.
Well, that's even more. I'm sure you know more about Carleton's Prize than I do, and that's even more evidence that there really was something to that story, and that the British did fire on it. The Valcour Bay, it's really a strait between Valcour Island and New York, has been fairly thoroughly gone over, and they've collected a lot of cannonballs, pieces of cannon, other implements of remnants of the battle, including the gunboat Philadelphia, which was raised in its entirety in the 1930s.
Jack, let's go to September of 1776. At this point, the Americans know that General Carleton and the British forces, they're coming down Lake Champlain at some point. The question probably is at that point, when are they coming? So Benedict Arnold goes up the lake and kind of scouts out the best place for this battle to take place. What is Benedict Arnold looking for in terms of he eventually chooses Valcour Island, but what's he thinking about as he goes up the lake and is looking for a place to stage this battle?
Well, yes, he took the fleet as far as they'd completed it at that time. It was about 6 gunboats and a couple of schooners that they'd rigged up with cannons. And he went all the way up to the northern end of Lake Champlain, even up into the Richelieu River. The British were at a place that they called in those days St. John's on the Richelieu River in Canada, building their fleet. And he wanted to get intelligence about what they were doing. He sent scouts up there to sort of hang around and see what was going on. But he also needed to train the crews. A lot of the crews of these gunboats and the other war vessels were drawn from the Army, and they were, many of them were men who knew nothing about sailing whatsoever. So he had to train them and get them ready to do some kind of battle with the British. And he also wanted to, for himself and for the captains of the gunboats, to learn the terrain, to learn the layout of the lake up there. So there are so many, as anybody that's familiar with northern part of Lake Champlain, hundreds of islands, coves, inlets, and they would go around and take soundings and see how deep they were, or could they go through this inlet and explore essentially and become familiar with the terrain there, which gave him a very big advantage, because when the British came down, came south on the lake, they had never been there before. They had maps or charts, but they hadn't had any practice sailing. This was their first entry into Lake Champlain. So they were essentially feeling their way along, and whereas Arnold knew all the ins and outs and where he could place his fleet and where he could escape. And so that proved to be a huge advantage for the Americans, whereas they had considerably less firepower and less ammunition and less of everything, really, than the British did when they had completed their fleet.
Does Arnold know at this time that the British fleet is going to vastly outnumber him?
He never really determined. There was conflicting reports came back to him from these scouts, and he knew that they were building a lot of boats. The one thing that surprised the Americans on October 11th was the British had built a frigate. They'd actually been working on it up in the St. Lawrence River, and they dismantled it, brought it up to St. John's, put it back together. And that was a huge ocean-going, three-masted, square-rig ocean-going ship, massive broadside of cannon, and pretty much could outshoot anything the Americans had. Fortunately, in the battle at Valcour Island, that ship was not able to get into the battle because it's very hard to sail against the wind if you have a square-rig ship. Later in the battle, as it moved down the lake, it became dominant. They were, because it could go faster than the Americans, and it could shoot a lot, with a lot more power. So it was somewhat of a surprise that morning, on the morning of October 11th, when they finally did spot the British fleet, of how much power they had.
You know, as you were mentioning, during the month of September, Benedict Arnold is up exploring, investigating different parts of the lake. They're thinking that the British are coming almost any day, but there's a real waiting period there where General Carleton really takes his time. And that, a lot of that, I think, has to do, as you explain in the book, of the building of this huge ship. So I guess one of the what-ifs that I thought of during this was, what if Carleton had come earlier and hadn't waited until October 11th to come down, but had come down on, the first week of September? Would that have changed anything?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right about that, Bob. It's one of his biggest mistakes, and probably his biggest mistake, was to spend the time to build that frigate. He had a massive advantage by the end of August, and he could have come down the lake then. The like many generals, Carleton was cautious, and he wanted to make sure, and then he wanted to make double sure that he was going to win. But he didn't recognize, which Benedict Arnold, by contrast, did recognize, that one of your main resources in war is time. And so Carleton allowed this time to go by. It allowed Americans to add to their fleet. They sent up three slightly larger gunboats at the end of September, just before the British came down. And it also used up the time that he would have needed to lay siege to Fort Ticonderoga. So when he finally got down defeated the American fleet, got down to Fort Ticonderoga, it was getting cold. I mean, anybody that's from Vermont knows it's how cold it gets, even in September, and certainly by November, it was getting very cold. And at that point, General Carleton lost his nerve and went back to Canada.
Just remarkable to think about what might have happened had General Carleton come down in September and then hit Fort Ticonderoga, you know, 6 weeks before he did, of what might have happened. Let's talk to Paul, who is calling from Port Henry, New York. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you. We have a small connection to Arnold. In his diary, he writes, this is before the battle, of stopping at the Cheever Mines, which are just north of Port Henry, and using blacks to load iron ore on, which he then takes to Skeenwood, now Whitehall, in the use of the construction of the bateaus down there. The mines are closed now, but remnants of them are still here. I was interested in the fact that there were blacks working in the mines. He doesn't call them slaves, but he does mention blacks.
Yes, well, that's interesting, Paul. I had not heard that about the mines. I know they were tapping the resources along the lake to get the materials they needed to build the boats, because Skeensboro, which is, as you mentioned, is now Whitehall, in those days it was very remote from anywhere. It was very hard to get to, and that's where the Americans had decided to build their fleet. So they needed the lumber that they got along Lake Champlain. There was a sawmill there. I guess there was ironworks to a certain extent that they could forge things that they needed out of iron. They were very resourceful. I have to say, the term Yankee ingenuity was really a big factor in the Revolutionary War. I mean, they made do, and they knew how to do it. And that this would be just another example of that. As far as whether there were free black people involved, I don't know about that. Certainly, slavery was pretty common. General Schuyler, for example, who had a big estate in what's now Schuylerville, or was then called Saratoga, was one of the biggest slave owners in Albany, and that has become controversial in the last year. They're talking about taking down his statue in Albany, and you know, it's offensive to some people. So it was sort of a mixed bag, and I don't know there's any record of any black soldiers or participants in the battle itself.
Jack, when the battle unfolds, the British are coming down Lake Champlain. Benedict Arnold and the American fleet sort of hidden behind Valcour Island. British looking around, they can't find the Americans, and they're wondering what's going on. Eventually, they do find them, and they have a pretty intense battle for a day in the straits there, Valcour Straits. You described it really as almost like two prize fighters going at it. It's back and forth with just close combat of firing cannonballs back and forth. It is a pretty brutal battle.
Yeah, I think more people are probably familiar with. There's been a lot of novels written going back to Horatio Hornblower of what war was like in wooden boats in the age of the cannon, and particularly during the Napoleonic Wars, but even in the American Revolution, you could not take cover. There was no way to take cover because the cannonball that hit could easily blast through oak planks. So you just had to be lucky that you didn't get hit. If it did, the cannon fire would take down rigging of ships. It would, if it hit wood, it would send out the spray of splinters, which were quite lethal in themselves. There's about 30 to 40 Americans were killed during the battle. And when you were killed, they just threw your body overboard. They couldn't spend time to give you any kind of ceremony. That was just to get rid, to clear the decks. So one of the most brutal forms of warfare, and no running away. I mean, this, at least on land, if things worse comes to worse, you can start running. But on water, you had to stay in the ship and take what came.
So you have this all-day battle on October 11th, and it ends, nightfall comes. The British are thinking, hey, we're in pretty good shape. We've got Benedict Arnold and the American fleet trapped in these straits. We'll come finish them off the next day. How on earth does Benedict Arnold get the American fleet out of those straits and slip by the British forces in the middle of the night?
Well, I think what it came down to was what I mentioned before. During the month that he was waiting for the British, he was exploring and he was taking soundings. And whereas the British didn't, you know, were unfamiliar with the lake, the British were afraid at night to get very close to the shore because they didn't know where they would go aground. They didn't have the familiarity. Whereas he knew exactly, and all his captains knew exactly where they could go. And they had to trace a line along the New York shore in as far as they could get through the gap that the British left. And then because of a Sable Creek comes in there and there's a lot of shoals where a Sable Creek is, they had to begin to veer out towards the east and then get out into clear water in the middle of the lake. So it was really that familiarity that saved them. And I should mention the gunboat Philadelphia, which sank there sort of in the evening of after the battle, they got the men off, but the boat went to the bottom, was salvaged in the 1930s and is now in the Smithsonian Institute. It's really one of the most poignant relics of the war because it's the real thing. This is the boat that faced the British, and these are the guns that fired at the British. The boards on the deck of that ship did absorb the blood of men who were fighting for independence. So, I would also mention that the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum, which is in Vergennes, built an exact replica of that gunboat. Which they have at the museum there now in the water, and it gives you a really great sense of what it was like to be on a boat like that, and what the whole you can picture the events of that time by visiting that place. So that's a great resource as well.
Oh, it's great to know about that. Let's get a quick call in from Drew in Brattleboro. Hi, Drew. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Well, your authors kind of answered my question, but I'll ask it anyway. I was going through the town of Whitehall, New York, a number of years ago, and I noticed an interesting plaque that said that Whitehall was the home of the U.S. Navy. And I'm assuming it's because the boats that were made from the Battle of Valcour Island were constructed in Whitehall. Is that correct?
Yeah, Drew. That was it's a little bit fudged because there really was no navy in 1776. The Marine Expedition was organized by the Continental Army. All these men were members of the Continental Army, and the states had their individual navies, but they had not formed a national navy at that point. But it was the first naval fleet that was under the auspices of the United States that was sent up and fought on Lake Champlain. So in that case, I think they say it's the birthplace of the American Navy, and quite rightly. So you're correct about that.
Drew, thanks for your phone call. Jack, we got this tweet from Jonathan. Great topic. First learned about it courtesy of the plaque displayed at the Naval Memorial tucked behind the Echo Leahy Center for Lake Champlain, and immediately thought, this is huge. Why have I not learned of this before? I think it would make a great movie. Is there a movie on the horizon?
I hope so, Bob. It's a difficult subject to make a movie about, but I certainly agree. I usually refer to it as the most important unknown battle of the Revolutionary War. We didn't even get into the fact that once the British went back to Canada, 600 men from Ticonderoga actually marched down, joined George Washington's army in Pennsylvania, crossed the Delaware, and fought at Trenton. So they fought at Valcour Island in October, and they were down in fighting at Trenton in the great victory over the Hessians in December. So it's there's a lot of aspects to it that are quite fascinating.
That's another huge what if, Jack. What if Carleton had attacked Fort Ticonderoga and those soldiers were not able to go down south and join George Washington?
Yeah, Washington, knowing that the threat from the north had been neutralized, having these 600 men, it seems like it would have influenced his decision, but we'll never know because he didn't really record all the factors he considered. And he was taking a huge risk to go across the Delaware, so that's a perpetual unknown.
Jack Kelly is the author of Valcour, a fascinating history of a very important naval battle on Lake Champlain. Jack, many thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Bob. It's really been a pleasure.